Billy Bean has tried to reinvent a system that's been working for years.
You know, sabermetrics, in my opinion, in the last decade, last 10 years, has been the most overrated thing to come into baseball.
I believe there's a championship team that we could afford because everyone else undervalues them, like an island of misfit toys.
Go ahead, Hawk!
Let him have it!
It's the most overrated issue to come into baseball in the last 10, 15 years, and I stand by that because it's not ready yet.
But I wonder if he's heard of the Tampa Bay Rays.
I like the Rays.
Got an ugly girlfriend. Ugly girlfriend means no confidence.
By embracing analytics, sabermetrics, a financial economic philosophy, they have averaged 92 wins a year over the last 5 years.
The more numbers and the more information you bring into the game, the more instincts you take out of the game.
He is Mike, I am Greg, and we are talking baseball. A couple things we wanted to get to this week. We talked about it last week, but we never really got to it on the show, was a column that Tom Verducci wrote about, he says that patience at the plate is kind of hurting the game of baseball, slowing it down and taking the bat out of the hands of a lot of players, I guess is one way to state it. So we'll get to that. We also, in the same vein, we've got to get to the Hawk Harrelson, Brian Kenny debate. The sabermetrics thing, man, you throw that up to anybody, and you're always good for an argument, I think, with that particular topic. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And, of course, Roy Oswalt going to the Colorado Rockies. Mike sent me an email asking, is it a desperate move or a shrewd move? All that's what we're going to get to, but let's start out first, Mike. Let's talk a little bit about this Verducci column. He's basically saying that driving up the pitch counts, drawing the walk type of thing, you know, the whole sabermetrics approach to an at-bat is kind of not working anymore. What are your thoughts on that?
I have no idea how he came to the conclusions he came to, particularly with some of the things that he said about that it's the reason why it's slowing down. And, you know, he cites 40 plate appearances by Joey Votto as a reason why it's not working. You know, I respect Verducci as a writer. I read the entire thing. It's like, what the hell is this thing?
Well, I kind of get where he's coming from. I think that he used too small of a sample size. There's no doubt about it. I don't think you can take 40 at-bats by one player and use that to make such a blanket statement. But I do see where he's coming from in the idea that going to the plate with the mentality that you want to drive up the pitch count and work to the bullpen, that whole idea maybe has gotten to the point where good hitters are starting to let good pitches go by because maybe you get a great pitch to hit on a 1-0 count and you let it go. Maybe you're trying too hard to work the count into a deep count, like a 3-2, whatever. And I can see the argument from that side of it that, yeah, you've got guys that maybe are letting good pitches go by because they've got it so ingrained that they have to drive up the pitch count, work the count, do the whole bit to try to get on base that maybe it is hurting hitters. And again, I don't want to say that 40 at-bats by Joey Votto is a good sample size, but I do see the point Verducci's trying to make, and I think it's a legitimate one. But I'd have to see a much bigger sample size before I could say with absolute certainty that he's right. But I do see where he's coming from.
Let me ask you this. I actually have Votto's career splits pulled up right now via Baseball Reference. And if you were to take a guess what his OPS looked like with men on base, where would you put it? Over 1,160 at-bats.
Well, first off, you got to tell me what OPS is. Is that on base plus slugging?
Yes.
I would have to say it was probably pretty good because of the season he had last year.
1.029.
That's good.
And with runners in scoring position, 645 at-bats here, it's 1.084. So
you're basically saying Verducci's crazy then.
I'm saying that there are other stats I think that you have to kind of look at here that I feel like for somebody like Verducci, who, as I said, I usually like his work, it just felt like he's somebody that was kind of trying to troll the internet here with this article a little bit, because you look at things like the percentage of pitches that are first strikes, it's still practically identical to what it was years ago whenever people were instructed to swing at that first pitch. That hasn't changed, you know, and there's so many other stats that you can look at here that paint a fuller picture, but he's just taking two separate stats and trying to build his argument around it.
I can see where you're coming from. I'm not a saber guy, and by that I mean I don't discard it. I don't discount it. I just don't. I'm not very up to date with it. I don't understand it yet. And that's not to say that I don't agree with it, but I do see a point that he's making here, which I can see this happening, is that again, like I said, you know, you might have good hitters letting good pitches go by. Now that's not to say that they are or that they aren't. I don't have enough data in front of me to say that, but I can see the potential for that. Maybe that is a downside to the sabermetric approach to baseball. I don't know. Working in at bat, trying to build the pitch count up at the expense of letting good pitches go by could be a problem. So I do see that aspect of it.
And I honestly think that if he wanted to try and write that article, if he could find the heat maps, if he could find that kind of information that shows the location of the pitches rather than just taking, you know, particularly with like the 2013 data, using that as a thing, we're sixth of the way through the season. Look at the heat maps. Look at the Brooks baseball and some of those. See how many middle, you know, mid-center square for anybody who plays the show. See how many of those pitches they let go by. And I would assume that you wouldn't see much difference. You can't just look at it as a, particularly when you're going over several years. I mean, whenever you're looking at his approach, because it's not only the batter's approach that affects all of this, it's the pitcher's approach.
He says right now, okay, I'm reading the article, his slugging percentage with runners on base this year is 188. Only twice has he driven in a teammate with a hit, but he has an awesome on-base percentage. So the question, I guess, that comes out of that, is it okay that he has an awesome on-base percentage, but he's not driving in the runs? And again, I'm not a sabermetrics guy, so you have to answer that for me. Why is that not a problem?
Because I think at this point it's still noise and it will work itself out. I don't think he's doing anything fundamentally different than he's done in previous years. For example, you know, over his career where he's got a 6.06 slugging with runners in scoring position. And I think, you know, you give it enough at-bats and it's going to level out. It's going to regress to the mean.
Perfect segue into the Hawk Harrelson-Brian Kenny debate. Harrelson, and it's been duly noted throughout the internet, Harrelson and Brian Kenny kind of went at it. Hawk Harrelson said, among other things, that sabermetrics are the most overrated thing to come down the pike, blah, blah, blah. Brian Kenny, who is a big proponent of sabermetrics, took exception to that. They got into the whole big debate. But I'm going to ask you, as a sabermetrics guy, did anything that Hawk Harrelson said in this whole debate, did it all just seem idiotic to you, or did you think that he had a point at any level?
Honest, and this is something I've said elsewhere, I think most people who deride sabermetrics honestly have no idea what it actually means. And I blame the success of Moneyball because of that. You see it kind of done in really hacky Hollywood movies like that, the Clint Eastwood one from last year. Where,
oh, The Trouble with the Curve, right.
Yes, where the bad guy was so over the top that it's like, I don't need scouts, I've got this computer. And that's not at all what it is about. I mean, sabermetrics is basically just the idea to understand baseball more. That's it. Yes, there are teams that take some of the things that they learn through those approaches and try to improve their team. But it's not, you look at your computer and all of a sudden this great player that you knew is now terrible, and this guy who hit 250, you know, 20 years ago is now one of the best players who ever played. And that seems to be kind of the approach that some of the anti-Saber crowd appeals. I mean, you look back into the 40s. Branch Rickey was questioning the state of the stats that were being tabulated and trying to find his own. He was doing his own advanced baseball research. I mean, you could almost kind of call him, and I'm reading right here a blog post, was Branch Rickey the father of sabermetrics? You know, whenever you apply it in a team, it's about trying to make your team more efficient. It's about trying to, you know, discover talent that maybe hasn't gotten its fair shot and could thrive under specific situations. But so many people who deride it, I honestly think, have no idea what the hell it means.
I'd agree with that. There are aspects of sabermetrics, and again, I don't know enough about it to give you an informed argument against it. There are aspects of it that I question because it might just be simply a case that I just don't understand it well enough yet to get it. But it is, I will agree with that 100%. It is presented in such a way that to the average person who just looks at it and the way it's presented by the old school folks, they would make you believe that Billy Beane's trying to convince you that Scott Hatteberg was a better first baseman than Lou Gehrig because he got on base better, or, you know, he got more walks. And that's not the case. I understand that. I agree with you that the way it's portrayed by the old school approach is a real caricature of what it really is. I thought it was interesting when Hawk was on MLB with Brian Kenny and Harold Reynolds. Brian Kenny brought up the point. He said, don't you want to know, you know, all the percentages, this and that? And they both said no. And I thought, well, that's just idiotic. I mean, nobody says, even if you don't use it, Nobody says you have to. Nobody says you have to subscribe to it. But for God's sakes, when you sit there and say, okay, I know all this information is available, but I don't want to use it anyway, that to me, that's just stubbornness. That's not a way of making sabermetrics look bad. That just shows me that you just are not open-minded in any aspect. Because even if you don't use it, it's nice to know that it's there.
And, you know, as I said, I mean, I mentioned I was reading it last week. I kind of finished Moneyball. And, you know, what it is, I mean, it's an interesting look at a team's approach, but I don't think it's necessarily representative of the team's success that year in particular. I mean, it talks about the 2002 Oakland A's, everybody knows, and kind of similar to the movie, Eric Chavez is mentioned like half a page. Miguel Tejada is mentioned in one line where he's kind of derided for not taking enough walks. The three Oakland Aces are mentioned in passing by themselves. And, you know, so much of the book is about Hatterberg and Chad Bradford and, you know, these marginal players that they were able to pull value out of. But, I mean, it is just kind of the partial story. So I can understand if that's your only guide of reference, how it could be annoying, because the book is also written in this ultra condescending tone. But I still think that short terms what sabermetrics is overall.
I remember, I don't even, I think, I want to say it came on the 80s. I read one of the Bill James that was called The Historical Abstract for whatever year it was. And I read that book and I was sitting there going, he was talking about things like, you know, the old, if you got a right-handed pitcher, bring up a left-handed batter. And he was showing data that showed that this wasn't necessarily a good way to go, that there were guys that hit left-handed pitching better than they hit right-handed, you know, left-handed batters that hit left-handed pitching better than they hit right-handed pitching and all that. Even when I was reading it back then, I thought, okay, there's stuff here that these guys need to understand. And here we are, I don't even know how many years later. It's a long time later, and you've still got people fighting the stuff that I think is pretty obvious, like the on-base percentage. I think that if that on its own, well, let me tie that into the will to win type thing. Yeah, I think there's such a thing called the will to win. Absolutely. And to me, the guy, the will to win guy, is the guy that will go up there and go, I'll get on if it's a walk, if I get hit in the side of the head, base hit, whatever, I will do whatever I have to do to get on base. So from that aspect, I think that the will to win is a good example of sabermetrics. I think that you can't say that it doesn't play a role in that, because I think it does. I think a guy that will go up and get on base any way he possibly can, that's a guy with the will to win, in my book.
You know, you look at somebody like Josh Hamilton, and Josh Hamilton has come through in a lot of big situations. He's also kind of went away, and, you know, you could argue that in several things he cost the Rangers the division last year. You know, so much of it is about timing, and, you know, there are other things about the sabermetrics that people like to make fun of, like the fact that, you know, sacrifice bunting is looked down on. You know, it's not sacrifice bunting in general is a bad idea. It's just about 90% of the time it's a bad idea. If you're in a tie game in the eighth, if you're playing for one run and not for the big inning, you bet your ass you sacrifice there.
Well, then things like the stolen base, and I don't know what the sabermetrics, what the view is of stolen bases, but I do agree, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think one of the pillar philosophies behind sabermetrics is you don't give away outs. Is that right?
Right.
Now, from that aspect, yeah, I think that it's stolen. I think that anything you can do that you just hand the team an out is a bad idea. I think that a sacrifice bunt, and I've said this a million times watching a million games, you get a couple of guys on, and somebody comes up, and we're going to bunt. Now, all of a sudden, you've got two guys on with one out. And I understand, okay, you're playing the percentages. You don't want to ground into the double play, et cetera, et cetera. But in my book, the only time to ever sacrifice bunt is if the pitcher's at the plate. And that's it.
That was actually something that I was going to get to. If the front office kind of wants to keep the players in the dark about the percentages and everything, I do think that there is kind of some concern, because baseball is such a muscle movement kind of sport. I mean, it's not a sport that in large part, you know, save like your pitchers, catchers, calling pitches, that kind of thing, it's not a very cerebral sport. It's a very just kind of instinct-driven sport. So I don't think it's necessarily important for the players to have all that information, but I damn sure want my front office to.
Maybe sometime down the road, we will get out the list of all the Sabre stats and go over them because I can't reel them off the top of my head and talk about the ones that I have questions about that maybe you can explain to me. I because like I said, I'm not absolutely against it. But again, my problem is that a lot of my exposure to it is through the Moneyball movie book approach. And there are people out there, too, that I think that I've run across that are way, way, way too, you know, it works the other way, too. You've got the old school guys who are just like, I'm going to completely write it off. You've also got saber people that just, if you don't agree with every single aspect of it, look at you like you're some sort of idiot. It's a debate that could go on forever, but I'm with you. If information is there, if there is information that can make your team better, if you can find value in players that no one else sees, then absolutely you got to use it. And that's the big argument now. Well, look at the A's now. What happened to Billy Beam? Well, I can tell you what happened. A lot of other teams with more money to spend are started using the same research, and guess what? He's not out there able to just have his run of the store like he did before. Is that a fair assessment, you think?
Yeah, I do think that it is. It's no longer about, you know, having this stuff, because now it's, because the entire point of Moneyball as a concept, it wasn't necessarily even, you know, about the stats. It's more just about trying to find undervalued assets and being able to exploit them.
Way back in right field, that waiters, goodbye, a grand slam, game-winning home run for Matt Wieters.
Moving along, Roy Oswalt signs a minor league deal with the Colorado Rockies. And, Mike, you asked me the question, is this a desperate move or could it turn out to be a shrewd one? What are your thoughts on it?
As somebody who saw Roy Oswalt pitch several times last year, I'm going to apologize in advance to any Colorado Rockies fans. I'm sorry.
So not a smart move then.
He looked done last year. Every ball that he seemed to give up was just crushed. And whenever he was demoted to the bullpen, he threw a fit. And it was just, you know, there was talk at the time that he was going to walk out on the team. I understand that the Rockies have, like, no pitching whatsoever. I mean, they got back Chacin today, and that's the closest thing they have to a big league quality guy.
I will say this. I understand what they're hoping for with this, and if you're not putting a lot of money into it, okay. But my thinking on it is this. Roy Oswalt isn't going to give you anything more than maybe one of your top prospects at AAA, a pitching prospects at AAA is going to. So if you just need somebody to throw innings and all that, and yeah, if he becomes the Roy Oswalt of a few years ago, yeah, it's a very smart move. But let's be honest, he's 35. He got lit up last year. That ain't going to happen. It's just not. These guys, it's not like the old days, and we talked about this before the show. It's not like the old days back in the steroid era where guys got better at 35 years old. He's on the way down.
The steroid era really warped the way we looked at the way the players aged. I mean, guys, as you said, I mean, guys got better as they got into their late 30s, whereas the more natural aging curve, unless you are just a genetic freak, Nolan Ryan type, which, you know, shit, I'm not even saying that he never used steroids because I wasn't there. I honestly don't give a shit about steroids. You know, am I saying I want him to use them now? No, but do I hold anything against the guys that, you know, whenever they weren't even testing, that used? No, because you looked and you saw what the other players, you know, the other players were able to add years to their career, were able to make millions of dollars. And, you know, the commissioner, he might send out a memo, oh, guys, we shouldn't be doing steroids. But baseball wasn't serious about cleaning it up. Baseball was looking at the money coming in, and if baseball wasn't going to hold anything against these guys while they were playing, I think to do so after they're retired and things like the Hall of Fame voting is just writers patting themselves on the back. Where was this journalistic integrity whenever guys were using and you were playing stupid?
That is a great point. I agree 100% with everything you just said. I can't blame the players at all, because if everybody else is doing it and you're not, you're just watching yourself get sent right back down to AAA or you're sent packing. So I get the whole mentality of why everybody did it. What aggravated me to no end, and to this day still does, and you brought up the guilty parties here, Major League Baseball and the writers. It was so obvious to anyone that looked that there was something going on here. I can produce a radio show I did back in 1996. There was a guy in the Sporting News that wrote a little blurb where he had talked to some player, and this player told him that at least 80% of the players in Major League Baseball are on steroids. This was 1996. I started talking about it. I said, you look at a guy like Albert Bell, who crushed the ball, was, you know, had a couple of just supernatural seasons at the plate for the Indians. But, man, his temper, it's so obvious to anybody that looks, this is what's going on. You had Ken Caminiti. If you look at a picture of that guy from when he first came up to when, I think it was 96, 97, I can't remember which year, when he won the MVP for the Padres, I believe it was. My God, he looked like Popeye with his arms. And that's what aggravates me about it. It's not the players so much. I would love to be able to stand on moral high ground and say, you know what, Bonds, everybody else, right on down the line, none of you guys get in because you all cheated. But everybody knew it. No one said a word about it. I don't even know what the tipping point was that got everybody headed in the other direction on it. Well, it was probably when the home run record started falling, when Barry Bonds. I think if it had been a more likable player than Barry Bonds breaking Hank Aaron's record, I don't know that we might not still have steroids in the game today. But that's what aggravated me the most about it, was the fact that it was so obvious, and yet no one said a word. Not these holier-than-thou writers, certainly not Major League Baseball, and now all of a sudden we want to go back and retroactively punish everybody? I'm with you. I think that's wrong. I want to bring up a couple of names while we're talking about steroids real quick. Frank Thomas, you think he used or not?
I'm inclined to think no, because if he was a user, I mean, that was the first time I ever heard about steroids in baseball, was whenever he started making noise about other players using it. At the time, I think a lot of the media kind of hyped it as jealousy. But in the 90s, he was banging that drum and saying that baseball needs drug tests. And, you know, of course it could be possible that he would have still done it. But that'd just about be the biggest douchebag move I could think of.
I look back at him because I don't know if he's been retired long enough to be in the Hall of Fame discussion yet or not. In my book, and this is where the problem lies with the steroid era, you've got guys that were clean, and I'm going to go along with you because Frank Thomas, as he got older, started getting injuries, wasn't playing as well. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was clean. What do you do about a guy like that? Because his numbers, when compared to the same players of his era, are nowhere near as good. So how do you determine the Hall of Fame thing? That's the issue that, to me, the real issue with this. I mean, I don't think you can go back and punish anybody because it's all said and done now. And I think that also Barry Bonds in particular had a Hall of Fame career before he ever took steroids. So I don't know that it's fair to say, well, we're going to keep you up because you did steroids for the last few years of your career, when he certainly had a Hall of Fame career up to that point. But the question I'm asking, I guess, is what do you do about the Fred McGriffs, the Frank Thomases, the guys that we think were clean, and their numbers are going to look pale in comparison to the guys that weren't?
I mean, I think Thomas is absolutely a first ballot Hall of Famer. I actually think he goes up this year or maybe next year. Yeah, I mean, he's somebody who, you know, was easily, and I think you have to compare him with their time. I mean, particularly in, you know, the early to mid-90s, I don't think there was any question that, you know, you look at him, you look at Ken Griffey Jr., they're the best hitters in the game. How many times, I mean, during those seasons did you think, I mean, you know, Miguel Cabrera did last year, but he was going after that triple crown every season.
It'll just be interesting to see how it plays out, because I think that Frank Thomas is a Hall of Famer. I brought up another name, Fred McGriff. I'm not so sure. I think that his numbers in any era put him in the Hall of the very, very good, but not quite the Hall of Fame. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, because you are going to see players get punished, Bonds in particular. And like I said, let me ask you about that. I brought that up. Had it been a more likable player that had broken Hank Aaron's record, do you think that it would be viewed differently?
Very possibly. Particularly in his later seasons. Yes, he was using stuff. I still don't think that, you know, those were some of the best seasons of baseball I think we'll ever see. And those were some of the base, you know, there was a year where his on-base percentage was like 600.
Yeah. I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know what made me think of it, but I remember, I don't know what year it was, that he was intentionally walked and it drove in a run. That's how afraid they were to pitch to him back then. That just blows my mind. Steroids or not, I mean, and again, you've got to have the talent. I mean, you can take all the steroids in the world. If you're not good already, it's not going to help you that much.
I'm going to look here, and this is all through FanGraphs. And this is using their weighted runs created plus. It's similar to OPS, but it uses weighted on base average, which because OPS assigns the same value to a point of slugging and a point of on base, whereas they're clearly different. You know, a home run is obviously more valuable than a single, you know, as far as that goes. So it uses that kind of like OPS plus. 100 is average.
Okay.
And this was his 2001 to 2004 years. 234, 244, 212, 233.
Not bad.
The wins above average, and this was, well, 1 year he was playing terrible defense, but 12.5, 12.4, 10.1, 11.6.
That's wins above replacement, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I could never sit here and seriously with a straight face argue that he didn't have great seasons during that era.
Did the performance-enhancing drugs help him recover, you know, stay fresh day after day? Did it probably, you know, did make him a little bit – did it make him stronger? Sure. But steroids can help, particularly in a sport as grueling as baseball. They ain't going to make you Barry Bonds even at that point in your career.
That's my thing. And people always say, you know, the argument is like, well, the steroids made them stronger. Yeah, to a degree. But what people don't understand about steroids, I've taken steroids a few times throughout my life legally. And it wasn't like I was all of a sudden able to hit a ball 40 feet farther than I was before. What it was, you never got tired. That's the difference. So what Barry Bonds was doing wasn't like, it didn't make his talent any better. It just made it so that by the fourth game of a four-game series, he wasn't as run down as, say, a player not taking steroids would be. If you're in a game and say, you know, by your third at bat, if it's 90 degrees out, you know, under normal circumstances, you're going to be tired, worn out. If you're on steroids, you don't feel as bad. So you're more consistent. That's the big difference. Barry Bonds, and you can love him, hate him, whatever. I stand by the fact that he stopped and retired the day before he ever took his first steroid, still would have been a Hall of Famer. Steroids or not, the guy was still one of the greatest players we've ever seen. I don't like the fact that he did the steroids. I don't particularly like the fact that he broke the record of one of my all-time favorite players in Henry Aaron. But you know what? He did it, and we got to live with it. And you can't put an asterisk by it. You can't take it away. How do you handle it? You just got to look at it and go, hey, that was the era. That's the way it was, and we just got to move forward. I think that's the only way it can be handled at this point.
Yeah, I agree there. I mean, there are dead ball eras. There are eras that had a lot more offense, and I think that, you know, you give it a little bit of time, and I do think that that's going to be how it's going to be with baseball, too. It's just going to be the steroid era.
Right, because if you look at every era of baseball, there's always been an issue. You go back to the 30s and the 20s, 30s, 40s. Okay, yeah, there were a lot of great numbers put up. We talked about Hack Wilson before the show, 190 or whatever it was, runs batted in one season. Okay, that's great. That's all well and good. But he wasn't playing against the best talent that was available because of the color line. So how do you got to judge that era based on that. And I think that with steroids, it's got to be the same thing. You've got to look at it from the same viewpoint. It was the era. That's the way it worked. And there's just no other way around it. And every era in baseball has had its problems. And this one's going to be no different in that aspect. So, and I'm sure that the era that we're in now, somewhere down the road, will be looked at from a perspective that maybe we're not even aware of yet. But you can't just throw it all out. It all happened, whether we like it or not.
There's a line drive deep left center field. This is going to win it. Drew Stubbs doubles off the left center field wall, and the Indians will walk home with a 7-6 win.
Speaking of cheating, poor Clay Buchholz finally comes out, has a great season, and guess what? Now they're saying he's loading up the ball. What do you think, Mike?
Is it right what he's doing? No, probably not. Are there Hall of Famers who put that shit all over their ball? Absolutely. I mean, you know, whenever it first came out, I was a little more skeptical. Now that more people are kind of going back and, you know, he's being very obtuse whenever they're kind of trying to talk to him about it, and I'm a little more inclined to believe it. And this is something where, while as steroid users get derided as the scum of the earth, you know, spitballers and guys who steal signs and guys who participate in this kind of, you know, against the rule cheating get looked at as guys who really want to win.
That was the question I was going to ask. Why is it that some forms of cheating in baseball are not only okay, But you look at these guys as innovative, and they have the quote-unquote will to win and all that other stuff. You had a steroids guy who really, if you look at it, trying to gain a couple extra points in your batting average or your on-base percentage, maybe driving a couple extra runs, how is that any different from Gaylord Perry spending a career scuffing the ball, putting stuff all over it? And he wasn't the only one, believe me. But Clay Buchholz, yeah, is he loading the baseball? Absolutely. All you got to do is look at the forearm thing where it shines and all that. I mean, we saw it with was it Kenny Rogers a few years ago with the Tigers?
Yeah, with the entire
right. It happens all the time, but I guess because it's happened for so long, it's okay. It's okay if you can make a ball, you know, drop off the edge of a table because you cut it or put a substance on it. That's all right. Even though it's quote unquote an unfair advantage, that's okay. But steroids aren't. I mean, it's kind of hypocritical. But yeah, I think he's absolutely loading the ball. I mean, I don't know what better explanation there would be for his ERA to drop the way it has since last year. But hey, and you'll notice too, and I noticed this in the article that I read, that no one, as far as I know, no active players came out and said anything about it. It was what's his name, Dirk Hayhurst, the guy that wrote the bullpen gospels, and I forget the other person that brought it up.
Jack Morris.
Yeah, okay, Jack. Sure. That the split finger fastball you used to throw, it always dropped like that naturally. Please, come on. I don't know how close of attention people pay to this sort of stuff, but if you watch a baseball game and you'll see an umpire just put a ball like, okay, we're taking that one out, we're putting this one in. You know, it's not just because the ball, it might be because it got scuffed. This, that, or the other thing. So pitchers are always looking for that edge. I mean, I know when I played, and I told you about this, is the holy triumvirate of cheating. You've got the pitcher, the catcher, and believe it or not, the first baseman can get involved in this stuff. And I know when Whitey Ford played, he used to cut the ball. He wore his wedding ring when he pitched, and he would cut the ball. And if you cut it, like get a little scuff on it, a little cut, whatever, you can get a hell of a break on it, right? Well, it came a point where the umpire came out and said, Whitey, there's something wrong with your shirt. We're going to send you back to the dugout, and when you come back after fixing your shirt, that wedding ring better not be with you. So he got caught that way. Didn't get thrown out of the game or anything. Well, guess what happened next? Elston Howard, his catcher, started sharpening one of the buckles on his shin straps, and he would scuff the ball for him. So, I don't know where I'm going with that, but the point I'm making is that, first off, Clay Buchholz isn't the only guy doing this. Everybody does it. It doesn't make it right, but let's not get all bent out of shape because he's being a little more brazen about it. That's, I guess, what I'm trying to say.
In an article by Verducci about this thing, he kind of tells secondhand a story about George Steinbrenner and Lou Piniella, where Steinbrenner had, I guess, seen it on TV or whatever, or from the owner's box. He called Lou Piniella, who was managing the Yankees at the time, to have him check the other pitcher for cheating. And the response was, but George, our guy is cheating too.
Exactly. It's kind of hypocritical to get all bent out of shape about steroids and then sit back and laugh at stories about Whitey Ford and Lou Piniella and all the guys that have done it over the years. And, well, God, was it Joe Niekro? They came out, you know, his knuckleball was knuckling way better than it usually does, and all of a sudden somebody says there's something wrong here. They come out, and he tries to do the old who, me, throws his hands up in the air, and an emery board comes flying out of his back pocket. It happens all the time. And like I said, the first baseman can get in on it. It's easy to scuff up a ball or to load a ball up if you've got the substance, like say on a pickoff throw, okay? You might throw over to first, and I know because I've done this, and you're not trying to pick the guy off. You're getting me the ball so I can take something to my glove, put it back on it, and give it back to you. I mean, it's a whole system. And like I said, Clay Buchholz is just being, like you said, obtuse about it. My advice to him is whatever that stuff is you've got on your arm, get rid of it and put it somewhere else, because that's what's going to get you caught.
And that's the biggest thing. I mean, I think unlike kind of steroid use, this is stuff that's kind of seen as ingrained into the spirit of baseball because it's been happening since there's been baseball.
Deep to left field. That one is on its way. And good night. We'll see you tomorrow. Buster Posey ends it. On a 3-2 pitch, a line drive home run, a walk-off for the Giants as they beat L.A.
Who won the week, Mike? Who won the week this week in baseball?
You know what? I was very, very tempted to say the Tigers, I mean, they are, they just kind of came into first place. They're tied for first place at the moment with the Royals. But with that division, I don't think that they'll ever spend a day out of first place for the rest of the season. But I also, I kind of want to give a shout out to my Rangers, because, you know, they just came through, swept what was at the time the hottest team in the American League to now be tied with for the best record. So, you know, I'm gonna give it to both. I'm gonna share the love a little bit.
So we've got a split vote. Detroit and the Rangers win the week with you.
Yes.
I'm going to say this about your Rangers. You talk about Detroit probably not being out of first place the rest of the way. I'm going to say the same thing about the Rangers. The Angels are 8 games under .500. We're into May now. Guess what, Angel fans? Get ready for a repeat performance of last year. Seattle, they're not going to go anywhere. Oakland, I can see them hanging tough, but I think the Rangers are the class of that division. So there you go. For me, who won the week, I've got two. I've got a player. And I've got a team. And first, my player, and this is just because I used to play the position. I know how tough this is. Who won the week for me? Chris Iannetta. He caught all 19 innings of that extra inning game the other night. And that's just for those scoring at home. That's 2 games plus an extra inning, and he caught every single one of them. So just on that alone, I'm going to say he won the week. And, Mike, you're going to love this one. I'm going to say for me, who won the week? The St. Louis Cardinals. 7-3 in their last 10, including 6 in a row. They are now in first place in the National League Central. They've moved 2.5 games ahead of the Reds, 3 ahead of the Pirates. Right now they're playing really good baseball. So for me, they are who won the week, the Cardinals. And, of course, Chris Iannetta, 19 innings behind the plate. I got to give it up for that. So that, there you go. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up? Wait, no. We got to do plugs, man. Got to do plugs.
Oh, yeah. And before we do plugs, actually, I want to make an apology. Last week, I identified the Diamondbacks owner and CEO as Kyle Kendrick, and it's Ken Kendrick. Ken Kendrick is the little man who drove down the value of its players. Kyle Kendrick is a pitcher for the Phillies.
So Kyle Kendrick, everything's okay. No one's, you can all stop blaming him for the problems with the Diamondbacks. Guys walking around going, "What the hell did I have to do with it?" But all right. Anyway, real quick before we go, let's do the plugs. You go first.
This week on Off the Top Rope, a pro wrestling podcast, we are watching WCW Sold Out 98 with Jason Mann from WrestleSpective. So I'm excited about that. And I might have another podcast launching this week. I'm hoping to get done this week, my hip hop podcast. So.
Cool. We are just podcasting fools, folks, let me tell you. Yeah. As always, Basically a Sports Show. You can check it out at basicallyasportsshow.com. We do the live streaming thing Mondays at 10. And speaking of another podcast, musically oriented and all that, I am working on one that is going to either be called the Classic Rockcast or just the Rockcast, where we are going to talk about rock music. So that should be fun too. But anyway, that's going to wrap it up for this week of Mike and Greg Talk Baseball. We will see you next time.
Go Rangers.
Go, I don't care. Just get me fantasy points. That's what I need. All right, we'll talk to you all next time.
Well, you know, sabermetrics, in my opinion, in the last decade, last 10 years, has been the most overrated thing to come into baseball.
Why would he feel the need to attack the advances in knowledge in baseball over the last 25 years?
It's got a lot of people fired because it didn't work.
Go ahead, Hawk.
Let him have it.
It's the most overrated issue to come into baseball in the last 10 or 15 years, and I stand by that because it's not ready yet.
But I wonder if he's heard of the Tampa Bay Rays. Before 2007, they didn't have one single winning season. By embracing analytics, sabermetrics, a financial economic philosophy, they have averaged 92 wins a year over the last 5 years.
The more numbers and the more information you bring into the game, the more instincts you take out of the game.
Wouldn't you want to know what the actual percentages were?
No. Because you got to be in every game is different, Brian. When you can put some of those categories, you know, you got your OBPS and all that and the VORPs. When they put in TWTW, that's the will to win.
The will to win is terrific, but if you're gritty and gutty and it's not turning into bases and runs or preventing runs, it's of very little value.
The performance is W. That's the performance.
It does work.
All right.
You missed the revolution.
This is a kid's game. It always has been. It always will be. And it's a game of that TWTW, the will to win.
I like the riff.
Got an ugly girlfriend. Ugly girlfriend means no confidence.
Try again.